Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021. Today, cash flow analysis. We are really coming toward the end of this happy time we had together. And I can't remember, I think we have one more quiz. This week is the last week of textbook material. Then next week will be special topics, which are completely lecture-based, starting with ethics, and then also we will cover the Federal Reserve in that sequence. The topic today, I'll get into the topic today in just a few minutes. This is actually what's happening at the end of this course with this cash flow analysis, valuation of the corporation, fits together with what I do as when we bring in these international delegations from West Africa and the Caribbean and South America. They want to know what I'm going to be teaching you. So you're seeing sort of like what I show them. Interestingly enough, in quite a few cases, their knowledge of finance is not really the kind that we teach in a class like this. So I have to do some quick background with them before I can get started, which I won't have to do so much with you. This is not a difficult subject, but it is something where I have a PowerPoint presentation. It's sort of a customized version of a Cengage that I've modified over the years so that it fits better together with what's out there in the field, best practices. And I will be posting that online for you to have. I should be able to do that Wednesday. I have to do a few modifications because it's still for the Management Development International, so I'll have to take out some of the references to that in there. But anyway, that'll be available for this subject. And also today I've got to do a little bit of finish-up work on break-even analysis. But first, the numbers. As you can see, no. Madam, is this a good day or a bad day on the street? Is it a great day or just a sort of good day? Sort of good day. It's not a very hard up. As you can see, the market, one thing is they're all up. All of them are up, which is a good thing. But they're not dramatically up. There's not some, wow, this is a huge up day kind of thing. But it's better than a down day any day of the week, at least for most traders. And, it's like, it's kind of interesting because the Dow is up the most, then the NASDAQ, and then the S&P 500. Kind of hard to call what's going on here, but the markets are generally in a good mood right now. Talking over the weekend with traders, of course, you've always got that thing, yeah, the crash is coming any day now, and then, of course, they all go and buy on the opening bell kind of thing. So the rumors that there's a crash are not going to happen. The crash is not going to happen until it happens. And then everyone will say, see, I told you. Of course, they didn't. They were saying that all along. Now, crude, it's starting to make its move back upward again. There is a lot of pressure from the United States and from Europe to get the oil-producing countries to turn on the spigots, to keep the price of oil from going through the roof. A lot of pressure. And the Saudis have always had this, we want to help kind of thing, a good relationship with the West because we sell them these awesome weapons systems and all that kind of great stuff. And we put up with silly things like, you know, one of their crown princes murdering people so that we can keep this nice relationship. So the Saudis keep the spigot flowing to the extent that they can. However, oil still wants to try to find its way upwards. So it's a balance of forces right now. But yes, we're going to get $90 a barrel here soon enough, within probably by the end of the semester, I would imagine. gold and silver have had their. See, gold, there was a neckline at about 1800. It seems to have found its way past that neckline, and it's staying above it. Now, that, of course, metals going up is a sign of inflation, that they are reflecting inflationary pressures, inflation concerns. Is that what's going on here? Maybe a little bit, but I wouldn't be betting on gold for the short term anyway. Okay, the 10-year bond. We're up so far today 4 basis points, so that means that the yield is going up, the price is going down. So the price going down, that means that the money is going out of bonds and maybe a little bit of it into the metals, but it's going into stocks. There's nothing huge going on here. But you are seeing some portfolio adjustment downward on the bond in the bond markets for the time being. Now, of course, it's hard to say what's going on in other parts of the world, but the Financial Times, FTSE 100, is just bouncing around. It has no direction right now. And the Nikkei, just a sour. It was just kind of a grouchy mood. It wasn't anything major, obviously. 0.35% down isn't anything at all. But it just was just in a crabby mood over there on the other side of the world. But that's enough of that for the time being. I do want to show you a couple of final things here over the next couple of class days. I want to show you how to do short sales if you want to be a short trader. If you want to be a bear and make money in a bear market, I'll show you how to do it. Now, the funny thing is that there has been a tradition of short selling being this fun world for rich, big brokerage houses. They could short sell, they could do these short sales all the time and always have a nice little pile of money pouring in week over week. And then the idiots at Wall Street Bets started coming in and blowing it for them. And they lost some serious money, and now they're a little more cautious. But short selling is something that can be done, and I'll show you how to do it. Matter of fact, I might even see if I can take a position and see what happens if a simulated position in a specific stock or something, see if we can make money off a stock that's going to go down. Show you how you make money in being bearish on a stock. However, some of the things that I show you in a class like this are not that used. They're a little bit more arcane. That is, you don't see it that much, but it does lead to something that is used in the corporate world. I try to make this course as relevant as possible. But sometimes there are these things that I show you that have been around for literally centuries. Like I talked to you about the payback period method. That's been around since the early Renaissance. And then there are other things that are in our business calculations, our inventory of tools that have been around for ages. One of them is break-even analysis. And in showing it in a simple context, it's actually very simple, very easy to understand, and quite obvious. Taking it a little further, though, it can get a little complicated, but I put some numbers together. God, I forgot to bring my paper to class with me, so I'll have to try to do this from memory. About how you use this in the real world, because it is used, break-even analysis. Essentially, the question is, how many units do I have to sell of a product in order for that product to be profitable for me in an accounting sense or even in an economic sense? So if the profit is equal to my revenue, total revenue, minus my total cost, well, that's pretty obvious. And the total revenue, we could break down into the price per unit times the quantity. And the total cost, we could break down into the variable cost and the fixed cost. There are costs that are associated with each unit, and then there are costs that are there whether you sell one unit, no units, or a million units. And I don't know if I gave it to you last time, but in my business as a professional artist and photographer, I will have these costs that are there whether I sell anything or a lot. The fee for the exhibition, I have to pay that, whether I sell anything or whether or not I sell anything. Also, there is the display itself, that the fixed capital of the nice pop-up tent, the big steel racks and the hangers and all that the artwork goes on, and the table and the rack cards. All of those are fixed costs. But then there are the variable costs. They go up with the amount that I sell. So in other words, price times quantity minus the variable cost per unit times the number of units, and then you got that fixed cost there. Just park there. And as you go down the line, we could say, factor out the quantity like that, and that's your profit. Now this, see this price per unit minus variable cost per unit? It has an old traditional name. It's not correct, but the term that I've heard my whole life is this is called unit margin. If I sell it at $50 per unit and it costs me $20 per unit, then my unit margin would be $30. This is just an old term, and you might hear this term to this day. It's unit margin. Now, notice something interesting. This is actually a linear equation. This is a y equals mx plus b. That's all it is. It's just a linear equation. About as simple as you can get for a business type of model. Cap M is the same way. It just is not as obvious. So in other words, the unit margin is the slope, and the fixed cost, the negative fixed cost, is a y-intercept. So in other words, visually, you could say, okay, here's my profit, and here's my quantity. So it looks like this. Down here is the fixed cost, and this rise over run is your unit margin. For those of you who are into linear algebra and all that, very basic concept. And it's actually pretty darn accurate for real life, as far as you're going to start out in a hole. You're going to have that fixed cost that you're going to have to overcome. You're going to crawl out of that hole selling units. And at some point, you have sold enough of them that you've covered that fixed cost, and then you're in positive territory. Now, interestingly enough, just as a side point on this, you could have very low fixed costs, but a very shallow price margin. In other words, your price over your variable cost per unit is not very much. But you also don't have much in the way of fixed costs involved either. This would be for a budget type of item. For example, good example these days are apps. If you could develop an app, the fixed cost of doing that is really very small, tiny. But you're going to sell it for 99 cents a unit or 49 cents a unit or something like that. So your unit margin is going to be very shallow. So you have to sell thousands of them to be able to make anything off it. And that's why it's so important for you to get on the Apple Play Store, on the Google Play Store, and get some exposure. And you find any way you can. You go to Twitter, Snapchat, TikTok, whatever you can, just to get the volume up, because that's how you make the money, is on volume. You have to sell a lot of them. This was the way it was back in the 1800s late 1800s, and then through the 1900s. Some of the great financial empires were done with very low margins per unit. You sell the candy for a penny, it costs you a half a penny to make it. But if you sell a billion of those to sweet tooth kids who want themselves some tooth decay, you make a fortune. Because essentially, it doesn't take much for you to get out of your hole. I mean, it doesn't cost much to make a candy, to have a candy machine. You make the candy, you have the dropper, you take it over, and a wrapper just wraps it up and then spits it into these bags. It's not actually that much to it. But then you have to sell a lot of them. And of course, Kraft did. So did other companies like Bazooka, the Bazooka bubblegum. I'll bet not one of you remembers that in here. Oh, God. Or all of the other ones that had, or the ones who did the little trinket toys that go in the machines that you turn, put in a quarter and you turn the crank. All of that was part of the game. Was very cheap stuff, low margin on each one, but if you sold millions of them, you became, over a period of years, a millionaire family and an empire. Okay, on the other hand, you had early automobile companies. Making the factory was tremendously expensive. But what you could do is sell the car at a much higher price than what the variable cost of making it was. Your labor was cheap, your parts were cheap, but you had to crawl out of a big hole. So Henry Ford was one of those who went into did the mass production thing. All of this is by way of explaining what this is in real life. And interestingly enough, every business will have a profit profile line. Every business will. Some of them have very steep lines. Some of them have very shallow lines. Some of them have a low y-intercept. Some of them have a y-intercept that's closer to the axis, one way or the other. However, there will be a Q star such that 0 equals P minus V times that Q star minus the fixed cost of production. In other words, break even. Q star is break even. Output. Sorry for a little math notation there. This is our goal. And like I said, my usual forgetfulness, I'm going to have to try to remember the numbers. I might have to simplify them. I'm going to show you one from my own company. Okay, solving for this, we can say FC equals P minus V times Q star. So Q star equals fixed cost over P minus V. That's your break even. You notice that as your unit margin increases, your break even decreases. That's like, duh. Yeah. So in other words, you want to have a decent distance between price per unit and variable cost per unit. You want to have that. Whether that is a good idea as far as your marketing strategy goes or not, that's for the marketing people to decide. This is their game, is finding that all elusive price point. And notice the higher your fixed cost, the longer your haul is up to break even. That fixed cost goes up, your break even quantity goes up. That's why you try to minimize the load. Here's the thing though, is that in some industries, your fixed costs are just going to be ridiculously large. Oil companies, manufacturing companies, you name it, things like that, they're just going to have a huge FC, so your break-even quantity is just going to have to be pretty big.
And the only way you can compensate is to have a big unit margin. In other words, get your price way above what your variable costs are. Now, that might be that might work, that might not work. See, the price is going to be driven. You can't just decide your price. A lot of it has to do with what your the market will bear. What's your competition? What's the desirability of your product at different price points? All of that. Price isn't something you just decide. It's going to be decided for you to some extent or another. Your variable cost. Now, there's some extent to which you can beat down your variable cost. You can always fight. Look, you know, I deal with a supplier. Look, I need a better price. Can you give me a better price? Come on, I've been with you for this long. I'm giving you business. I even tell people that I sell my artwork to that I got your company provided supplies. I do all that for you. Come on, give me a lower price. But then you have the other thing, too. Variable costs would include probably your employees. And that's why when these prices go up, you're going to be on the side of the workers right now. When you get up there and you're the bosses and the managers, you're going to be a bitch about it. When you're paying a $21 per hour to a 16-year-old to work at McDonald's, there's your variable cost going through the roof. So first thing you're going to have to do is see if you can bring your prices up. If you can't bring your prices up, then you're just going to have to deal with it, and you're going to have a much longer haul to break even on the profit. That's just the reality of it. It's not something where we've got to take care of the workers. Yes, we do. We have to give them a living wage. Well, probably we do that too. But don't bitch when that means that your break-even quantity is going to go through the frickin' roof. That's just the reality of it. You're on the other side of the equation, or you're about to be on the other side of the equation. You're going to be the bosses, the managers, the leaders. So you got to figure out how we're going to deal with it when this variable cost of labor goes through the sky, and when your energy costs go through the roof too, and all those other things that are variable with the output level that you're creating. Let me give you an example. And like I should have brought this in with me, but okay. Take a typical 30 by 20 framed artwork that I will sell at a show. Now, the total amount variable cost per unit. If I have several different groupings, smaller and larger, but let's stick with the 30-inch by 20-inch grouping. The variable cost for one of those, that would include the frame, the acid-free backing, the nice mats around it, the print itself, which would be archival to last for 400 years, for God's sake, then the dust-free, the dust-protected backing, and then the wires and the hooks and all that, it will come for the typical piece that I do. Now, I think this is the right number, $332. That's what it's going to cost me for one of those. Okay, so now, let's talk about what it's going to cost for a typical show. The app fee is going to be usually about $25 to $50. $50 is where I go now. The booth fee is going to run me typically $250, but if I want to do a big show in Chicago, that's going to be up to $3,000. But that's typical for a show in the suburbs or someplace like Chicago suburbs or someplace in St. Louis or on the East Coast somewhere. Okay, so the setup materials for a show are going to run me about $300. That's the frames, racks, fabrics to cover the tent. It's a sunk cost. The tent is a sunk cost. Okay, that's enough. There are other fees, but that'll give you an idea of what I'm facing here. That's $600. But I also have to drive there. I'm not even going to include that. On the road for 4 hours to hang out with a bunch of other gypsies, tramps, and thieves and all of that kind of stuff. gas going back and forth, wear on the car. It's probably going to run $150. So, hell, let's put that in there, too. So we're up to $750 just to get the show going. Okay? So, let's say that I charge. Someone's going to piss all over themselves because I'm going to say $600. I'm going to sell my artwork for. So let's do it. Do this. 750 divided by 600 less 232. So how many do I have to sell? 3. That's exactly right. No, I can't sell 2.04. 3 is break even. So I have to stand there and get 3 buyers in a 2-day show to pony up for the money. And everyone above that is gravy. And you're saying, well, you son of a bitch, $600 and it costs you to make that $232? Well, you see, what's going to happen next is this, and this is part of the business story. I come out of that show and I've got, let's say I sell 4. That's $2,400. Let's say I sell 4. And then I paid $232 times 4 for those. Fixed costs are not relevant anymore. That's money down the toilet. $2,400 minus 4 times 232. Pretty sure that's actually that right number. $1,472. Wow, I can go to a nice restaurant. I did really freaking well there. No, I did not. You see, because I have now depleted my inventory by 4 works, which means that I have to replace those. So that meal that I was planning to have at Denny's with 2 grand slams and extra desserts of hot fudge sundae ain't going to happen because I've got to pay to rebuild my inventory from the show. This is why you have to sell, sell, sell. You will sell your butt if it's going to make you money. Well, not really. I mean, not unless they offer me a lot. But you have to sell. And that's why in business, where we are, where you are and I am, we are like craven animals. That's the bottom line, is we have to sell, and we have to keep selling. I have to make as much distance as I can between what I take into the cash drawer and what went out to get those sales to happen, the cost of goods sold plus the fixed cost. It's really, it makes us look like we're greedy, you know, hungry. $600 for that crap of yours? Yeah, and I'm going to jack up the price this year because I want to eat. So this is one of those real-life lessons in a finance course where we talk about the brass tacks of actually surviving from one day to the next. And every time you finish a show, in my business, the first thing you do is you think, got to get the inventory rebuilt, got to figure out where the next show is going to be and all of that. It's just a constant thing. You keep going forward, just like a shark. You don't live if you don't keep swimming. You don't get better if you don't keep eating things that are in front of you. Anyway, enough of that nonsense. Now, let me go on here to something a little happier. Okay, enough. Now, this whole lecture that I'm doing on cash flow analysis, again, there is a PowerPoint that's like it was at one time, Cengage's, but I have modified it, added to it, and put in all kinds of extra details so that it has definitely diverged. Now, you can always look at the PowerPoint that Cengage provides, but it's not the same one as this, even though it has sort of the same title. It's not the same one as this. This one's got a number of modifications in it. But it begins with that old difference between accounting and finance. In accounting, we care about operations. Let's try this. Sir, are you going to be a millionaire someday? Well, right now, what we care about is how you're going to survive to tomorrow. You see, if you keep your mind on that millionaire out there, you're going to forget to eat today, and then you're going to starve tomorrow. In finance, yes, we have to talk about the long haul, but we have to separate that ideal out there from the day-to-day that we have to live through. You as leaders in the business world, you have to think about that long strategic vision. But don't get too far involved in that. I mean, the thing that I learned to hate in my time as a consultant were the big ideas people. The ones who had all these grand ideas and they had all these little people do the silly stuff that was actually the work behind it. I had a couple of young people come to me last year. They had an app that they had a great idea for. I can't describe it to you. It was rather adult app, but it was a brilliant idea. And I said, okay, have you written the code for it? And they said, no, we know a couple of guys who can write code. That's nothing. Of course, in other words, they had the brilliant ideas and someone else was going to have to do the work of it. What we're doing in this is talking about that operations aspect of finance. The long haul is out there somewhere. So when I'm talking, you'll hear me repeatedly using the word operating. So if it ain't an operating cost, it's not something that I care about. If it isn't bringing in the money, or if it isn't money coming in, or if it isn't money going out to keep the operation running, I don't want to hear about it. Another important principle, and I think I brought this up before, we have a separation principle in finance. You separate the cash flows of a project from the financing of the project. You get the unlevered cash flow, free cash flow. You drill it down. You don't pay attention to interest expense, dividends, any of that. You get all of the operations down to how much money there is after you pay for everything with the money that comes in. And then you say, okay, here's what we have that we can pay for this project to happen. So in other words, you come down to the bottom line. You've got $30 million. Of free cash flow, positive $30 million. Okay, so that would go to maybe we sell stock and that would pay dividends, or maybe we borrow and that would pay the interest expense, all of those things, or we put it back into retained earnings to grow the company. But one way or the other, we need to get it down to that level where whatever is down there at free cash flow line, that's how we pay for what we did up here. That separation principle is actually quite critical. Otherwise, you're messing You're confusing what actually is going to make the money with what you need that money to pay for. You get kind of the hang of this, and I didn't actually make... I thought this sounds kind of phony in a way for a long time, and then as I did business, I began to realize it's one of those things when you're up to your butt in alligators, it's hard to remember that you're supposed to clean out the swamp. You've got to get that swamp cleaned out, and then whatever is down there at the end, then there's your gravy for this. So I take you through this, and you're going to hear me say operating revenues. I don't care about your revenues from your investments over here or up there. I want to know what money came in because of this project. And then the next thing that will come down, operating expenses. What keeps this project running? The paying the people their salaries and their wages, because if you don't do that, they're going to walk out on you. What pays for the light bills? What pays for the electricity, the internet, the gas bills, all that? What pays the mailing expenses to ship stuff out? What pays for the marketing to get the people to buy the stuff? Operating expenses. Now, quite frequently, operating expenses are... I got to be careful about saying this. They're very often variable costs. They go up and down with how much you sell. Operating expenses generally kind of move. Some don't. Some are fixed. There's no question about that. Some are fixed. But operating, oftentimes, it's something that the more you make, the more you're going to spend on operations, like wages. I mean, the more people you hire, theoretically, the more you're going to produce output, except for managers. Okay, but again, interest expense will not be counted. That's something that's going to be paid once we figure out that the project works and how much money do we have to finance it. One thing that I want to caution about this. You can finance projects, obviously, debt or equity. Okay, debt, you borrow. Equity, you've got internally generated equity, what you made from your operations. And, or you can sell stock. Okay, you've got those three different ways. Debt or equity, and equity, use the funds that belong to shareholders, your profit, and or sell stock. Interestingly, the debt looks like the expensive one. I mean, if you sell stock, or you just use the profits that you've got in the bank, it doesn't look like you're actually spending any, that there's a cost to it. Oh, but there is. And actually, as you saw earlier, the cost of equity is considerably higher, at least for quite a while, than the cost of debt. So even though debt looks like it's more expensive right up front, it's actually cheaper over the long haul. Okay, all that having been said, two other things. Taxes. We consider taxes an operating expense because, at least theoretically, if you don't pay your taxes, your business is shut down. Okay? So it's considered, even though it doesn't, in a way, it doesn't contribute to your operations, if you don't pay your taxes, then Uncle Sam is going to close your doors and put your butt in jail. So taxes are operating. Another thing, depreciation. And I've gone through this endlessly, and some of you have actually been in my office. I talked to you about this camera lens, $4,500 camera lens. I spent $4,500, but it doesn't register as that with the for reporting purposes. I have to capitalize it and then depreciate it over 5 years. Some of you have seen that lens, so you kind of got an idea of why it's $4,500. But the thing, though, is that the reality is that there's going to be a minus depreciation line. We leave that there because it's going to protect some of our revenues from taxes. But then when the smoke is cleared and we've gotten down past the earnings line, we have to add that depreciation expense back in because it never happened. But what we do have to do is in the year of purchase, actually subtract out the real capital expenditure, because that was real cash flow. So, and I caution that the term NOPAT, N-O-P-A-T, has become in vogue in recent years. Your textbook mentions it, uses the term NOPAT. But you will still see a lot of textbooks and PowerPoints and online resources. They are not using the term net operating profit after taxes yet. They're using the term incremental earnings, which doesn't really convey as much. But here's the thing. And I'm going to fuss about this one more time to you. Incremental. Incremental. In other words, the extra. The extra. The revenues that are coming in from this project. You don't let this project spill with others unless there's a really good reason. Now, before I go on, I need to distinguish two types of projects. There are new projects, a great new idea that you got, factory, wholesale, buy wholesale, sell retail, testing equipment, the whole nine yards, marketing, campaign, focus groups, the whole nine yards. And then there are replacement projects. These are projects where you are getting something to replace something that is already there, primarily because of some cost saving that is involved in it. It might also be that you have to do it because some regulation has changed. But one way or the other, a replacement project is sort of like negatives of a new project. A new project is extra revenue that's coming in from this project. The replacement projects are less money going out. So in other words, if you have a fleet of trucks that's costing $15,000 a month, and you can replace that with a fleet that runs at $10,000 a month, well, then your incremental savings is $15,000 minus $10,000. So those kinds of projects are actually, interestingly, just about as common as new projects when you have to replace a fleet of trucks because of fuel savings, or you have to replace something, a factory, some part of a factory, because robotics are cheaper than people, or anything of that nature, then you've got a replacement project. It behaves similarly, very similarly to your normal project. It's just that you have to recognize that you're not taking money in. You're looking at saving money that is going out. Now, the incremental, again, is the extra. You can't live in a thought process where, well, this project is going to help these projects over here. You would have to have something really very specific that is causing a positive externality to occur. Here's one, and your textbook kind of slips over. They actually address it, but they don't want to be too politically incorrect about it. You see, we see sometimes in case studies where there will be an argument that we should do this project. Part of the revenue is how much benefit we are going to give to the environment. Don't ever do that. Mother Gaia can take care of herself. I mean, she doesn't care about you. She'll send a tornado and throw your ass all over Kansas. So don't ever say anything like, well, there's this positive externality for the world by what we're doing. You need to show real dollars in these things. So when we're talking about incremental, we're talking about hard cash. How much extra money is going to come in from this? Now, you also have to get very real about the negative externalities. Specifically, as I have told you before, about cannibalism. You do not want a project that is going to make a product that eats revenue out of something else. Unless it is supposed to, and it's okay for it to, because you're making more out of the new product than you are out of the old ones. Oftentimes, this happens with consumer goods, where over a period of time, a product that was super popular for a long time, you don't want to kill it because it has brand loyalty. For God's sake, brand loyalty is so important. It's also impossible to value, really. But brand loyalty. Okay, so you've got the brand loyalty, but you know that this product isn't being bought by younger demographics or by new demographics that are beginning to have a lot of spending power. So you know you've got to get a new product in there. And you know that this new product is going to slowly erode the purchase, the revenues from the old product. Oh, there are so many examples of this. The shampoos from the 1950s, 1960s that were hugely popular. And then they slowly faded away. They are still on shelves. A number of them are actually still on the shelves. But those companies also have much better product, more modern products on the shelves. An example would have been, well, just off the top of my head, Prel shampoo. Prel was just an enormous success at the time that it came out. And it was one of those products that was made for the television era, because in early television, visuality was so huge. They would take this bottle of Prel and they would drop a pearl into it. And it would slowly drop down as this low baritone announcer said, Prel is thick, rich, and luxurious. And literally the people would just say, yeah. And then they show the leading brand drop the pearl and it would go drop right down to the bottom. The visuality was huge and it impacted a whole generation. So you can still find Prel on the shelves, but the company that makes it now has much better products. Also, just simply separation, discrimination in separating products of the same kind by demographic groups so they don't cannibalize each other. I talked about cars do that. Shampoos do that. Hotels do that. All kinds of things so that they don't eat each other's revenues. So the same bank that will make really great loans to their fancy upper middle class and rich clients, they're the same ones who run payday loans at ungodly, staggering 2,000% interest rates. They just know how to keep the market separate. Okay, so anyway, be careful. Positive externalities, not all that common unless you deliberately make them. Negative externalities, you need to recognize if they're happening, manage them, or simply avoid them. So that's that. Okay, incremental. So whenever I say revenue, I'm talking about incremental revenue. When I say cost, I'm talking about incremental cost. So through the meat grinder, you've got your revenues. Now, you're going to have your sales, general, and administrative expense, SG&A. Sales, general, and administrative expenses. And you're going to have your depreciation expense. And again, that's not a real expense, but it's a reality that it's going to protect some of that revenue from taxes down below. This brings us to operating income. Or operating profit, whatever you want to call it. Otherwise known as EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes.
Now, in accounting, the next thing that happens is minus interest expense. That does not happen with us because it's not operating. The next thing we're going to do is minus the taxes. Oftentimes, we will take the tax rate times this one. Now, again here, we had for a... Okay. The tax rate was, for a long time, stable at 39%. That was still very low compared to what it was for decades, where it had been 90 and 70%. And then it dropped down and to 39%. And it stayed there stable for years. And then in 2017, the Congress and the president at the time cut the top tax bracket to 21%. Now, there was hope that the budget reconciliation that was done over the past couple of weeks would get it back up to 39%. But we have two holdouts who call themselves moderates, both in the hands of some very, shall we say, conservative interests, who are saying that they're not going to go with that because that would be a tax increase. So now that we're at 21%, anything that takes it back to 39% is a tax increase. And so politically, it may turn out that we have to be stuck with 21%. For the purposes of most textbooks, you're still seeing 39% or a simplified 40%. So, you know, there's that. But one way or the other, this thing right here, your book oftentimes calls this incremental earnings. That's not a good term for it. The best term is NOPAT, net operating profit after taxes. NOPAT. It has picked up so much currency over the past 5 years that almost, that typically when I'm talking with corporate finance types of people, they'll say NOPAT. It's just how, it's become part of our lingo. So if you don't have to be in finance to know how to use finance terms. It will get you more credibility with the finance people, no matter what your particular area of specialization is. And I tell this to finance people too. The more you know about the terminology of other areas of business, the more you can work together because you're speaking more of the same language. Give me a second here. I'm not going to be able to. I should get a deduction for all these stupid things that I use. Okay. So there we are at NOPAT, net operating profit after taxes. Again, there's that operating. Okay, so now comes the next part. So from here, we are going to pull free cash flow. Free cash flow. We're going to take that NOPAT, and we're going to add back the depreciation expense. Because it never really happened. All it did was protect. We had it there because it protected. One thing, I've said this before. It used to be that depreciation expense was always reported on the income statement of a company. No matter, you just look at, there's the depreciation expense. So I can add it back in. A lot of companies now, they don't even show it on the income statement. It's there, but they don't have it as a separate line. You have to go to the statement of cash flows to find the depreciation expense. And sometimes it's depreciation and amortization, whatever. Okay, now the real thing, the capital expenditures. What really went out? And then this nasty, the change in net operating working capital. In other words, the money that flowed out into inventory, accounts receivable, you don't see it on the income statement, but it is a bleed off. See, when I build inventory, I know I say these things over and over. I just want to get it so that it becomes second nature to you. When I buy inventory during the off season, that inventory is not an expense. I can't say minus. So those frames and all that artwork that I do, I can't do anything about that on my income statement. So in December 31, when my year ends, I've blown thousands of dollars on new artwork, the frames and all that, and in the storage and all that. There it is sitting there. The money went out of my pocket, but I can't say a darn thing about it. I can't say anything about that on my taxes, on my income statement. It's just like it didn't exist. And yet there's that money, tweet, 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 going out there, away. So I have to have some place where I can actually recognize that, because it really happened. So in other words, my current assets went up against my current liabilities. That was a cash loss. So a change that is positive in net operating working capital is a bleed off of free cash flow. Yeah, okay. Okay, net operating working capital is your current assets minus your current liabilities. So if current assets go up against current liabilities, then NOWC goes up. If current assets went down against current liabilities, then NOWC goes down. So the delta of net operating working capital is going to be the net operating working capital now minus what it was the last period. That's how we can tell if I put money into net operating working capital or got money out. So in other words, if net operating working capital goes, okay, if current assets go up against current liabilities, then that is negative, that I hurt myself. If current assets go down, like if I don't pay some bills, my current liabilities go up, then I'm in good shape. So this one is the pain in the butt. What I will do is, I'll do this in the next class. I'll just open up some, did I do Tesla? Did I show you Tesla in here? The free cash flow, I did? Okay. I mean, that one's just like, you get this. You get the NOPAT. Add the depreciation back, subtract capital expenditures, subtract the net operating working capital. And with Tesla, you get a negative $9 billion for last year. Now, here's a rule. Negative $9 billion is not a good thing, because there's something here I want to emphasize about free cash flow. This is not just a theoretical thing. If you have negative free cash flow, that had to be brought in somewhere. That had to be financed. So when Tesla had negative $9 billion, that's not one of those, oh, well, next year will be better. No, that's where the hell do we get the $9 billion we need? Because you cannot, it actually has to be paid. That's $9 billion that had to be paid. So how is that happening year over year over year with this company? Well, that would depend upon whose ox would be gored if the company went into the black hole that it should. So the financing, that negative $9 billion, is actually, there's a check that, well, a bunch of checks were written to cover that. Because otherwise, the company would simply switch off. It's just like when free cash flow is positive, okay, where do we spend that? Okay, on interest expense, maybe on another project, or put it into retained earnings, dividends. Yeah, it's used. In one way or another, it's used. So if it's negative, in one way or another, it has to be brought in. So that's why this free cash flow is such an important thing, is because this is telling us what actually happened. Now, let me take you one.
And really, the one thing that you don't want to do is make this a pain in the ass. On the final exam, I will give you a real company's current assets and current liabilities for 2 years running. And I'll simply say, what was the change in net operating working capital? Again, let me reemphasize that. There will just be a problem, and it will be a real company. I'll say, okay, targets. Well, here, let me do something real quick. I don't know why I didn't pull this up to begin with. SEC.gov. Filings. Company filing search. Well, let me do something new. NFLX. Let's Netflix and chill. Okay, that was stupid. Okay, let me find a K. Okay, filing. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to download the actual Excel sheet for Netflix. And you could do this just to make sure. Is there some reason that sucked? How did that happen? I thought I clicked on that. Is it actually saving it? Oh, usually you got that thing up there. Okay. Downloads. Okay, I see. Okay, so what I'm going to do over here is I'll do this a cheap shot way. Consolidated earnings. Statement of, would it be that hard for them to say, look at this. You see there's no depreciation expense or amortization. Do you see how it's not in there anywhere as a term? So you'd have to run over to the statement of cash flows to find it. But let me not do that right now. Statement of cash. Okay, here we go. So your current assets. Okay. So let me do 2020 and 2019. And then we're going to do NOWC. NOWC. And so for 2020, it would be equal to the current assets minus the current liabilities. Really? Are you kidding me? Did I do that right? Almost 10. Okay, and then you just copy it over. Wait. Am I smoking the wrong herbs? Holy cow, do you see what that was? And then the delta. Equals that minus that. Holy cow. $2.6 billion increase in net operating working capital. So in other words, they bled $2.6 billion off their free cash flow. Let me make sure you see that. Their net operating working capital went from negative $677 million up to a positive $1.956 billion. So in other words, it increased, net operating working capital increased by $2.632 billion. That would mean that was money that was absorbed into net operating working capital. $2.6 billion just went and went into a freezer, as it were. And so they bled out $2.6 billion. But you know what's really really upsetting me right now is I've been running through some of these. I always like to do some just before I do these lectures, just so I don't make a fool of myself stumbling over steps. But I've seen like maybe a half a dozen or more companies that I've looked at over the past couple of weeks where they've had these same kinds of incredible increases in net operating working capital. And retailer, there were a couple of retailers, there were a couple of manufacturers. This is an entertainment company. But I mean, what's this thing that's going on now with moving actual free cash flow into net operating working capital? In other words, depleting free cash flow. Now, look at this. Look at how much cash. I need to go real quick. I'll get down here. So in other words, their debt, they brought in about $1 billion in extra debt to do this, okay? Well, how about stock? Oh, look at this. Common stock, they brought in about $500 million in common stock. They brought in some money, the retained earnings, so their retained earnings actually jumped by $2.5 billion, maybe $2.7 billion. That's where this came from. That's how they did this. Is that was just purely, well, some of it was debt, $1 billion in debt. And the rest of that, they put into their net operating working capital came from the increase in retained earnings. That's tough. I mean, more power to them, but I mean, that's kind of a scary situation they're in. Out of curiosity, let me do this real quick. I'm going to look very quickly at Yeehaw Finance. Finance, and look at Netflix here, NFLX. Okay. Look at this. They don't pay a dividend. That means that they're not using any, they don't need any free cash flow to cover dividend. So that free cash flow, they can afford to have that free cash flow hit really hard by the change in net operating working capital. So, I mean, and their beta is low, so I mean, this, more power to them. I hope they finally find a series that actually is interesting one of these days. Anyway, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.